thousands of Georgians on food stamps have lost their benefits.
These are not the welfare queens that people sometimes talk about. These are very real people who may be looking for work, are trying to find work. They're struggling to find work. They're just not succeeding.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. A new investigation finds there may be lead in our water.
I don't know if that's the case everywhere, but it's certainly the case in Georgia that that violations tended not to get harsh punishment.
And a Georgia lawyer just might replace James Comey at the FBI.
President Trump tweeted that he's nominating Christopher Wray to be the new director of the FBI and called him a man of impeccable credentials. Wray was like, thanks, can I put that on my resume when you fire me?
All that and more coming up. First, the news. From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. In Georgia, is it safe to drink the water?
The law wants municipalities to test homes, single-family homes.
A new investigation finds many cities in Georgia may not protect your water as they should. That's ahead this hour. First, though, last week we heard from guitar legend Eric Johnson.
Whatever you learn, whatever you build musically, you want it to be. You want it to be music that people can appreciate, not necessarily stuff that people just marvel at.
And we asked for your favorite guitar heroes.
Name is Ace, the guitar maestro, Jeff Beck.
Melanie Harper tweets, Phil Keaggy is pretty amazing, but I think fewer people know about him. Neil Cassidy writes, Dickie Betts is the definition of guitar. There is and can only be one red guitar. Adam Dean says, Jimi Hendrix is my favorite of all time. Hard to deny his influence on every guitarist after him. Michelle Almy says, six words, Joe Bonamassa, Joan Bonamassa, Joe Bonamassa. And from Joel Cook, how could anyone compare Hendrix, King, Mustaine, Van Halen, Denver, and on and on? Point taken, Joel, but here's one of my favorites, Bonnie Raitt. Last week, we also talked about Wonder Woman's feminist credentials. Suzanne Miller from St. Simon's Island writes, isn't it frustrating that in 2017 we're still having a discussion on whether or not a woman is too attractive to be a serious feminist? The fact that a woman brought it up makes it even sadder to me. We always love to get your thoughts, so get them to us. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Earlier this year, the state of Georgia told food stamp recipients to get a job by April 1st or lose their benefits. The deadline passed, and now more than 7,000 people have lost their food benefits. That's roughly 62% of the state's recipients. With us now is Melissa Johnson, Senior Policy Analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Hi, Melissa.
Hello.
And also by phone, we have Craig Schneider, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you, Craig.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, Craig, what was behind this move to what ended up happening was removing thousands of people off of the food stamp rolls?
It's actually the reactivation of a law that was put into place during the Clinton era, during welfare reform, where they had said if you are able-bodied and an adult and without dependents, you should be working. That law was suspended for the 8 years of the recession, and it's being brought back now.
Why? Why is it being brought back now?
Well, I think that there is a philosophy shared by a lot of people that if you are on this government benefit and you are indeed able to work, then you should. And there's also some people who believe that they're by allowing people to receive this public benefit on and on, that people become dependent on it.
We actually went out and asked people for their opinion on food stamps and how difficult it should be to get them. Here are a couple people.
My name is Robert Lofton. I think there should be a process. I don't think it should be as hard as people want it to be. I think there are people who need them, they should get them, and people that don't need them shouldn't get them. I mean, it's black and white. It's real simple.
Mary Ann McFarlane. I live in Conyers, Georgia. I'm really not absolutely sure how hard they are to get, but I know of a couple people that have needed them and used them and then got back to work and didn't need them more, and it was a safety net during a short period of time that was very important for them.
Melissa, I want to harken back to Robert's comment here that there should be people who get them because they need them and people who don't get them because they don't. It sounds simple when he says that, but your whole purpose is to research things like this and find the complexities. How simple is it to determine who needs them and who doesn't?
Well, the federal government has set up guidelines to determine who needs food stamps. So you have to be pretty close to the poverty line. And we're talking around $26,000 for a family of three earning less than $26,000 a year. So we know through research that a family of three earning that little needs
some
help.
Yeah, that's not poverty. That's extreme poverty.
Exactly. They need some help with paying for food when they have to pay for other things like childcare and their housing and their utilities. So there's definitely a process in place for making sure that people who actually need the food stamps are getting them.
Now, the whole purpose of your organization is to educate and inform lawmakers, correct?
Yes.
So what have you told the lawmakers about this law and what impact it might have?
Well, we've informed them that this, like Craig said, that this is a time limit that was put in place by the federal government. And states have applied for waivers during the recession to lift this time limit so they didn't have to deal with it when people couldn't find jobs. However, as the unemployment rates have gotten back into a more acceptable range, these waivers have expired. And then, as Craig was saying, too, some states have voluntarily given up their ability to apply for waivers of this time limit. So we've informed lawmakers that giving up this time limit is detrimental for waiving this time limit is detrimental for people who need this food assistance, because in states that have given up this waiver, we see a drastic drop off in people accessing food assistance. And there's no connection between the people who are losing food assistance and their ability to get jobs.
No connection at
all. There's no evidence.
So, Craig, how does the debate fall out on this? Is this a partisan issue? I mean, I know you mentioned Clinton, who obviously is a Democrat, but does this fall out on party lines?
Yes, very much so. For a lot of folks, food stamps are the clearest symbol these days of welfare. So there's a sense on the right, and it doesn't always, you know, cut so cleanly, but indeed, people do have a lot of passionate views on welfare and food stamps. On the right, there's this sense that if you are able-bodied and you don't have any kids, you should be working. And if you're not working, there's a good chance that you're sort of ripping off the system, that you're milking the system. You know, you're sitting in front of the TV all day and you need to get up and get a job. And, or you shouldn't receive this assistance. They believe that there's a dignity in work, and that they praise this program for pushing people to sort of get off the couch. On the left, there's a sense that this population that we're talking about has a lot of challenges to getting work, that they very often have a low level of education. They have at times physical and mental problems that may prevent them from working. Some have a criminal record. They don't always have transportation. So there's this sense that they need help getting jobs. Some of them, they maybe have emotional problems that haven't been formally diagnosed.
Right. I'm just going to bring in one more comment. This is from an actual food stamp recipient named Kelly Brotherton in Indiana.
I want to work. I'm able to use my mind. I'm able to use my hands and to do a day's work. We want to make a living. Just help us do that.
Melissa, one of the beliefs is that programs like this, when you remove people's assistance, that it forces them to get a job. Is that true? Does that ever work?
We know through the benefit of hindsight, when you look at studies of work requirements that have been implemented in programs and public assistance programs throughout the 1990s, that work requirements in and of themselves do not push people into stable employment that reduces their poverty over the long term. What does work is ensuring that people have marketable skills, education, training. That is what works to make sure that people have jobs that can pay self-sustaining wages. Work requirements have been shown over and over again that they do not by themselves push people into jobs that pay good wages.
Which kind of backups the comment from Indiana. We have a tweet from Rabbit who says, if getting a job were so easy, they wouldn't have been on benefits, but I'm not down with kids going hungry, whoever their folks are. And that's the other question, Melissa, is what kind of effect does this end up having on children when their family loses food stamps?
It has a detrimental effect. We know that food stamps have positive effects for children who receive them. They've been linked to higher high school completion, less hospitalizations, better health for children. And though this time limit only applies to adults without children living in the home, that does not mean that these adults do not have children. They may have children who are not living with them. They may have not. They may be non-custodial parents. So we have to think through the implications there.
Here is a couple more thoughts from people that we spoke to in and around Atlanta.
My name is Terrell Bembury. I live in East Atlanta. They shouldn't just let any Joe Blow come up and get them just because you say you don't have a job or something of that nature. You know what I mean? I think it should be put into a situation where they kind of scrutinize it a little bit more. That's all.
My name is John Miller, and I'm an aeroscience spinner. My family used to be on food stamps. I can see why the government would tighten it because a lot of people do abuse it. I have seen that as well.
Craig, is this expected to save the state a lot of money?
Actually, food stamps are federal money. And there's a sense out there that they actually sort of add to the economy because you have, billions of dollars coming into the state economy through the federal government. The state will be making this statewide. Right now it's in about 24 counties. But the state is very much in favor of expanding the food stamp work requirements.
Melissa, do we have enough information about food stamps, the people who get them, and what effect they have to truly understand the implications of removing thousands of people off the rolls?
Well, we know through studies, once again, that people who have access to food stamps are more likely to not struggle with hunger, right? That seems quite obvious,
right?
But we have studies to confirm that, and we know that food is one of your most basic needs, so it's hard to concentrate on looking for work or being in a training program if you're hungry.
So is there any chance, Craig, that this will change, that in the end any of these people have a chance to go back onto food stamps?
If indeed they do have a handicap, they can appeal this and convince the state that indeed they cannot work. They might be reclassified and be able to get their food stamps without the work requirement, yes.
That is Craig Schneider. He's a reporter for the AJC, and we also spoke with Melissa Johnson, who is Senior Policy Analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Craig and Melissa, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Trump taps an Atlanta attorney to be the new FBI director. First, though, if you thought lead in the water was only a problem in Flint, you're wrong about that. This is On Second Thought. Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Lead pipes were banned decades ago, but as the people in Flint, Michigan know, not all of those lead pipes have been removed from our plumbing. A new investigation of Georgia's water systems shows some of the water in Georgia may be contaminated. Reporters Andy Miller of Georgia Health News and Brenda Goodman of WebMD reviewed lead testing records for water systems serving thousands of people. I spoke with both of them about the story. How do I know, Brenda, if my home I just bought in 2017 has lead anywhere in the connection between the water system and me?
You wouldn't necessarily. There are no laws in Georgia that require anyone to disclose to you if there's lead in the pipe that comes from the service main at the street to your house. So you wouldn't necessarily know if there's lead in that plumbing. And then you would probably need to get a plumber in to look at your interior pipes to find out if you have the kind of pipes that might have some lead or lead components in them.
So the reason I'm focusing so much on testing is because what you guys discovered when it comes to how our water is tested and how thorough that is shook me a little. I was very surprised at some of the things that you uncovered. So let's dig into what you found out. A, are there blanket regulations for how often a water system has to test and what facilities? Do they need to do a certain number of homes versus businesses?
The lead and copper rule basically outlines what has to happen. And basically, water systems, public water systems, have to test somewhere between 30 and 50 of their customers' homes to find out whether there's high lead levels.
Why homes instead of businesses?
Well, that's the way the rule and the law is focused on what the consumer is consuming. It's not really, it doesn't really have anything to do with what's happening at a gas station or a convenience store or something like that. And so what we found, surprisingly, is that a lot of water systems are testing homes that are not at high risk for lead poisoning. And that's what the EPA rule and the EPA wants. They want water systems to test the highest risk homes for lead contamination.
What makes a home high risk?
So there are three conditions that make a home high risk for lead. Under the EPA's lead and copper rule, make them it's called a tier one house. There are different tiers of risk, and there are three different conditions. One is if you have a lead service line, and that's what the EPA is most interested in. They want water systems to test their lead service lines before they test anything else. If a water system knows they have lead service lines, at least half the homes they test have to have lead service lines. The second condition is if a home is built in the 80s, between 82 and 88, and has copper pipes with melted lead joining those pipes, so it's lead solder. And the reason why those years are important is because the newer lead is, the more quickly it releases to water. And those were the last years when high amounts of lead were allowed in plumbing under the law. And the third condition is if you have lead pipes in your house. And I never ran across a case where that was true, but they have it written into the law. If you have actual lead pipes in your house.
Here's one wrinkle in what you found, which is that a lot of the places, as you say, that they were testing were not high risk. In fact, a number of municipalities or water systems were testing government employees' homes.
Right. And basically, that's just not what the law is all about. The law wants municipalities to test homes, single-family homes. And so those systems that did gas stations, city officials' homes, we can't tell what the intent was of these water systems, but clearly that's kind of like violates the spirit of the law, if not the law itself.
I was just going to say, there's no prohibition in the law against testing city employees' homes or water system employees' homes. There's nothing in the law that would prohibit that. But their homes are supposed to fall into one of those risk categories, and we found that often they don't.
They're not high risk for
lead. There's really no reason other than convenience why those homes should have been tested.
And one of the reasons this is so bad is because I may live in a place where they say we have no lead in our water, or it's below the parts per billion, which would be considered dangerous, and that may not be true because they're not testing high-risk homes. Is that accurate?
Right. They, you know, as Brenda says, the high-risk homes should be targeted across the board. And sometimes water systems can kind of get a dispensation to do other homes, but they have to exhaust the whole supply or of these high-risk homes. In other words, almost all of these municipalities have plenty of high-risk homes that they can go after.
One of the difficult things that makes that difficult, though, is getting people to agree to do the test. Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard to get homeowners to participate?
You know, that's a mystery because I have a 2-year-old daughter. And so if somebody said, hey, we want to test your house for lead, and I live in an old house, I would say, please bring me the bottles. Right. Let me do it. So I was a little bit taken aback, honestly, when water operators told us that they were having trouble recruiting volunteers. But we hear that again and again, not just in Georgia, but in other cities as well. We know that's been a big problem in Philadelphia. They've been trying to recruit people to test homes. They have lots of lead service lines there. They know it. They've been trying to recruit people to test homes, and they feel like can't get enough people to sign up for the testing.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with reporters Brenda Goodman of WebMD and Andy Miller of Georgia Health News. They've collaborated on this investigation into lead contamination in Georgia's water systems. Andy, from what your reporting describes, it doesn't seem like it's all that difficult to participate in testings, right? You don't use the water for 6 hours, which while you sleep, and then when you first get up in the morning, you get a sample and you leave it outside.
That's right. But there's this reluctance, as Brenda said, by many people. But I would think that you could find, you know, if a water system is diligent about this, and there are some that are, that they eventually find the people that will do this.
Let's talk about specific water systems then. Tell me a story about something that maybe surprised you. There were things that surprised me, but what surprised you in your reporting in terms of, A, how flawed the tests may have been, or the response of officials when you confronted or asked questions?
One thing that surprised us when we went to the town of Demarest in North Georgia, and we found that the addresses were commercial buildings. In fact, we found a couple empty lots that were addresses that they said they tested. So we found that there was,
empty lots with no plumbing that they couldn't have.
Exactly. They were just sitting there. And that's not the intent of the law, certainly. And we found a lot of that. We found that not just in Demarest, but in other places. One thing also that surprised us is there was kind of a lack of knowledge about this important thing of lead service lines. I mean, a lot of these water systems will say, oh, we don't have them, but it turns out that they may have them, but they just aren't looking for them. And these are the most dangerous situations for potential lead contamination.
That comes up in Atlanta, Brenda, because as I understand it, when you guys approached Atlanta city officials, they said there was zero lead anywhere in the water system. Is that correct?
Not exactly. In the days when they were installing the main pipes of the water system, those were made out of cast iron, and one end would be in a bell shape and the other end would be straight. So what they would do is they would take those two ends and fit them together and then pour molten lead around the gap to seal those pipes together. And we're by far not the only water system that has that configuration, but we still do have some of those lead joints in our water system. But they said, you know, unequivocally that we didn't have any lead service lines. And so we wanted to know more about that. We said, how can you say that? Because we know from historical records that at one time, Atlanta was one of the 50 largest cities in the country that had lead service lines. And so we started digging some more. We said, well, that was a long time ago. Are those pipes still in the ground? That's the question, right?
Yeah.
So we asked the Atlanta Water Department if they had any records called tap cards. Other cities have been looking for these tap cards. These are old records. They are index cards sometimes.
Yeah, they're pre-computer. They kept everything by hand. They were like the card catalog at the library.
Right. They're handwritten in pencil, beautiful cursive script. And so we asked them to look for them. They said, no, we don't have anything like that. But I had talked to some people in water in Georgia who knew that Atlanta still had some tap cards. So we went back to them again and said, hey, could you take a second look for us? Because we're pretty sure you've got them somewhere, but probably not very many people know where they are anymore in your water department. And so sure enough, on the second look, somebody came back to me and said, hey, we found them. They're in an old walk-in safe in the Atlanta Water Department, and you can come down and look at them if you want. So that was astonishing to us.
What did you find on the tap cards?
Well, we found the records that they did have lead connections and lead plumbing going into these homes all over in all these neighborhoods of Atlanta. And so the city finally came back to us and said, okay, we do have some lead service lines.
We may have some.
We may have some. Right. It may be like, what,
1%? 1% of all the pipes, yeah.
But there's a lot of pipes.
There's a lot of pipes.
There's a lot of, exactly. So,
so they went from saying, we definitely don't have any, to, well, we may have some.
Why is it so difficult to know where the lead is? Why is it so difficult to replace it?
Well, it's expensive to replace the pipes. I mean, even for a homeowner, it could be from your water meter into the house. If you have a lead service line from there to there, it could cost thousands of dollars to dig up your yard and to replace them. And cities, the cities have, you know, it's expensive to get rid of these things. Why we don't know where they are is a good question, is what cities are going after. Some cities like Boston and Washington, D.C. have tracked where these lead pipes are so that homeowners can know if they have them in their neighborhood.
And in many cases, these pipes were put in before we thought that lead was dangerous. Do we have a final answer on how much lead you can have in water before it becomes dangerous?
No, the EPA, in fact, this is incredible, isn't it? They're still working on trying to find out what that level is. So the EPA has an action limit. It's called a 15 parts per billion, and it's called an action limit because if a water system exceeds that for more than 10% of its homes, they have to take action. They have to notify all the customers in the system that there's a lead problem. They have to educate the public, and they have to change the water treatment so that it reduces the risk.
And then, right, and remember that the CDC says basically there's no safe level of lead for a child. They're just, you know, zero.
Right.
Which leads us to some of the people that you spoke to in your reporting who found out. In fact, there was one woman who got notice. She participated in the testing. She got notice that the lead in her water was above even the EPA limit, and there was no instruction for her on then what she should do next. Why not?
Well, that's a question for the water utilities. I mean, they absolutely should follow up. I mean, they're supposed to tell people who test high for lead within 30 days after they get the results. And we found one woman, another woman who basically didn't know until we called her, like 2 years after she had the high lead level test, and she was wondering, and she didn't know why. I mean, she was never informed by her water system, even though 2 years earlier she tested at a, you know, 17
parts
per billion.
So she'd been drinking lead
yep.
for dangerous
2 years
levels of
without,
lead for
without
at least
knowing
2 years.
Without knowing about it.
But in this particular case, and people will need to go back to your reporting to really get all of these details, but you're talking about water systems in which there's maybe lazy record keeping, there are tests that are very, very flawed, and there's even one official that at one point says, well, I don't rely on the information that you've brought up because I think that it's wrong. But there aren't a whole lot of either penalties. There aren't a lot of them. They're not often enforced in Georgia, from what I understand. And the bar for someone to be charged in this case is purposefully and willfully falsified documentation, which has never been met yet in our state.
The absence of that is troubling versus like a state like Ohio, which did charge some people.
And as did Michigan over Flint.
Yeah, yeah. So we found that there was, I don't want to say it was lax supervision, but it was certainly soft in terms of what would happen if a water operator did a violation of the rules. And I don't know if that's the case everywhere, but it's certainly the case in Georgia that that violations tended not to get harsh punishment. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the Georgia Environmental Protection Division only has 2 employees to oversee more than almost 2,000 water systems in the state, to enforce the tenets of the lead and copper rule, I should say. So they're already stretched. And it's been based on our review of emails and on the testing records, you know, they have adopted a kind of help them out policy when it comes to water systems. You know, if they find someone that's not doing it quite right, they tend to work with them, and they're supposed to do that, to try to correct the problem. But definitely we didn't see, I mean, one thing we didn't see for sure that was pretty troubling is that no one routinely checks these test sites to see if water systems are complying with the law.
So your reporting is upsetting and makes me afraid. And I wonder how you feel now about the water that you're drinking. Are you filtering your water now?
Yeah. I mean, I was filtering as soon as I heard about Flint. But definitely, I'm going to continue to filter. I don't feel any safer, definitely, after this reporting. And it has given us pause.
We filter, too. But I think Flint did one. Flint was a thunderbolt across public health and children's health. And I think the EPA has told state agencies like EPD that, look, start testing high-risk homes. Make sure you're testing high-risk homes. So the EPA is more involved since the Flint disaster, certainly.
That was Andy Miller of Georgia Health News and Brenda Goodman of WebMD. Their investigation of lead contamination in Georgia's water systems was released today. You can read it at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, an Atlanta lawyer might be the next director of the FBI. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we dive into the debate over school choice. We'll talk about what it is and we'll break down its pros and cons, but we'd love to have you join that conversation. Do you think school choice improves education? Or is it just another term for segregation? You can call and leave us a message with your opinion. It's 404-500-9457. Then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. President Trump announced his pick for the next person to lead the FBI last week, just a day before former director James Comey testified in the Senate. Trump's pick is Atlanta attorney Christopher Wray. And to discuss this choice, we have Kent Alexander, former U.S. attorney for the North District of Georgia. Hi there, Kent.
Hi, how are you?
How well do you know Christopher Wray?
Reasonably well. I hired him when I was U.S. attorney, so I got to know him particularly well then.
Was it a good hire?
Great hire.
So tell me, I mean, there are things that the American public is concerned about with the next FBI director. And one of the things I imagine concerns a lot of people is this idea of a loyalty oath that Trump has reportedly asked not just James Comey for, but has many of his employees he has asked them for, if we are to believe reports, and Trump himself. What do you think Christopher Wray might make of a loyalty oath?
It's one oath he wouldn't take. I think he'd take an oath to the Constitution, he'd take an oath to justice and doing the right thing. But a loyalty oath to any president just isn't the way he works.
What about Christopher Wray's approach to justice and to government in and of itself? How did he see himself as a member of law enforcement?
Well, he's a straight shooter. He's just right down the middle, really bright guy. And the only reason he went into the department at the start was because he likes doing the right thing. So for his money, I can't speak for Chris, but yeah, this is why I hired him. I was really struck by how he was driven by public service. He was driven by the Constitution. He was driven by what was the right thing to do. So having somebody like that at the FBI, particularly at a time like this, I think is key. And I was surprised and pleased when I saw the president announced he was going to nominate him.
But did you get any sense while working with Christopher of partisan politics, that any decisions were influenced by the fact that he's a Republican? Do you feel he was ever influenced by that?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the unique things about U.S. attorney's offices generally, but in Atlanta particularly, it's just a nonpartisan office. People come in, and I hired Republicans, I hired Democrats, but the way people approach prosecutions is just by the book. So in that office, I was always struck, and I spent 11 years there, by the lack of politics.
Let's hear James Comey. This is during his testimony before the Senate last week.
The nature of the FBI and the nature of its work requires that it not be the subject of political consideration. You see it in my testimony. I also tried to explain to him why it's in his interest and every president's interest for the FBI to be a part, in a way, because its credibility is important to a president and to the country.
How prepared do you think Christopher Wray would be, you are his boss, in terms of talking truth to power, in terms of being able to stand up for their own job against pressure?
Sure. Well, for starters, I was Chris's boss 20 years ago, and happily he's had a huge amount of experience between then and now.
That is correct.
But having kept up with him and kept up with his career, I think he's extraordinarily well prepared. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, he worked directly with FBI agents day to day, so he knows the down and dirty of how a case is made. At the Justice Department, he worked with Larry Thompson, who was Deputy Attorney General, who brought him up there as his right-hand man, basically. And he oversaw a lot of terrorism investigations. He worked with the FBI a lot. He operated the highest levels of the department. He then went on to head the criminal division of the Justice Department, which is basically the person who oversees all of the criminal prosecutions across the country and works directly with the FBI. So he's really been in the mix in Washington in a political setting, and he's also since really excelled as a private practitioner. So he really has it covered at all levels, so as prepared as anybody can be for a position like this.
Even though he's never worked with but not for the FBI.
Exactly. Much like Jim Comey, Judge Sessions, Bob Mueller, a lot of people who've been directors have been in exactly that position.
Before I let you go, I wanted to read you something, a comment that Representative John Conyers made. Conyers, of course, is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, and he's concerned about the choice. He says, quote, "I am deeply concerned the next director is being selected according to the criteria of a president whose campaign and administration are under investigation and who fired the prior FBI director on the basis of his zeal in investigating these matters and refusal to swear loyalty to the president." That sounds like he's saying, I'm concerned about Christopher Wray because he was selected by President Trump. How would you answer that?
Well, that means by definition, whoever the president selects, he's going to be concerned about. So that doesn't really concern me that much. I think it's a good time for people to start focusing less on the nominator, and who's controversial in many quarters, and more on the person being nominated. And I liken Chris in many ways to Neil Gorsuch, who's nominated, of course, as Supreme Court Justice. Both extraordinarily qualified people. They might view things politically different than others, but the president of the United States is Donald Trump, and he's a Republican president. He's charged with nominating people who share similar beliefs. I was pleased with Chris as a nominee, or he's not nominated yet, but
right.
If he is, I'm very pleased that his name surfaced because I know how independent he is, and he's somebody who would be, as I say, serving justice in the Constitution and not a particular person.
That is Kent Alexander. He's former U.S. Attorney for the North District of Georgia. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Now with us is John Iannarelli, a retired FBI special agent. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you. And by phone, we have Rhonda Cook, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, how are you?
Good. John, how much of the job of FBI director requires prior knowledge? In other words, let me ask you the same question I asked Kent. Are you concerned at all that the presumptive nominee is not somebody who has worked for the FBI?
Well, let me preface it by saying, first of all, I think Chris Wray will do a fine job. Is he the best pick for the job? I don't think so. When you look at prior directors, generally they have the substantive experience. For example, three of our prior FBI directors out of the five FBI directors the FBI has had over the course of time were federal judges. One FBI director had been an agent for a number of years as well. Comey was the first person to actually be slightly different and having not been a judge, but yet had the substantial experience that requires an understanding the working knowledge of how the FBI operates, the mission of the FBI, and also very important is understanding the culture of the FBI.
Well, then let me play for you another comment that James Comey made during his Senate testimony.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
How did you take those, John, the comments that the FBI is in disarray?
I would totally disagree with the FBI being in disarray. Directors, honestly, just like any other leader in the FBI, they come and they go. What you do have is 36,000 employees, 12,000 of which are FBI special agents who are hired and have taken the oath to the Constitution to do a job, regardless of who is at the helm. Business goes on, and to say that anything was in disarray would be absolutely incorrect.
Rhonda, you started your longer piece on Christopher Wray by describing his connection with Bob Mueller, who's now the special prosecutor investigating ties between the Trump administration and Russia, and also James Comey. How did Christopher Wray know both of those men?
They worked together. He was in the Justice Department when they had that infamous showdown involving then Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Over wiretapping.
Well, it was over extension of the surveillance that came after 9/11, yes.
And where did Christopher Wray come down in that argument?
From accounts that I've seen, there was a book that was written about Vice President Dick Cheney. What it explained was that he stopped Director Comey, or former Director Comey, in the hallway and said something to the effect, "I don't know what's going on, but if you all are going to jump, let me know so I can go with you." So at that time, James Comey and Bob Mueller, had drafted letters of resignation that they were ready to submit over this issue. And Christopher Wray was planning, as were a number of other people in the Department of Justice, planning to resign and protest over how the White House was handling that.
Christopher Wray also has a connection with another person whose name might be familiar, and that is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Here is Christie praising Christopher Wray's pick.
"And the president deserves extraordinary credit for going through a really deliberative process and coming to the conclusion of picking not a politician, but a law enforcement professional who has the respect in both sides of the aisle."
It's hard to hear him there. It sounds like he's in a restaurant or something, but he's saying that Christopher Wray is a law enforcement professional with respect on both sides of the aisle. Rhonda, what is Christopher Wray's connection to Chris Christie?
Well, he was his private attorney. He was Governor Christie's private attorney during the Travelgate saga.
The Bridgegate?
Bridgegate. As of this moment, Chris Wray is, as you know, a litigation partner for the law firm King & Spalding, and they have offices in Washington. And so he represented Governor Christie in that instance.
What do you think, John, are the necessary qualities that a successful FBI director needs?
So, again, I think Chris Wray is going to be fine, and I think he will do an adequate job. But I also think Chris Wray is a safe pick. If you're looking for somebody who's highly aggressive, somebody who understands the culture of the FBI, as well as the culture of law enforcement, which is very different than the culture of being a prosecutor or the practice of law, it's somebody who understands those aspects of what it takes to put together a complex investigation. The FBI, by its nature, are working violations that no other law enforcement agency literally in the world addresses. Some of these investigations, the statute of limitations are as long as 7 years because it takes so long to put these cases together, like an Enron-type case. Somebody with that frame of reference is the person who would be best to lead the FBI, but at the same time, you're looking at somebody who will be very aggressive, and perhaps at this time in the political culture, that's not what they're looking for to lead the FBI.
Well, let me try to get at what you're saying here. Does the FBI director, especially in this particular setting, need to have political savvy, do you think?
You know, I think understanding of the politics and being able to maneuver within those politics, but there's a reason the term of the director of the FBI is traditionally for 10 years, and that is so that you do not have to answer to one president over another. Director Louis Freeh was selected by Bill Clinton, yet clearly then became the nemesis to the Clintons to a certain degree later on. And that is because you may have selected me as director, but my job is to enforce the law regardless of politics. I think a director of the FBI has to understand certainly dealing with politics is going to be difficult, but you must rise above politics and do what is in the best interest of the country, regardless of what any politician, specifically any president, may wish for you to do.
Rhonda, how strong are Christopher Wray's connections to Georgia?
His wife is from here. Several generations have been here. At one point, I think it was her great-grandfather was an owner of the Atlanta Constitution. I understand that the road Howell Mill was named for her family. So he came here from, I believe, New York State, but his tie to Georgia is his wife, that he's been here for a few decades, so it's pretty solid.
And so, John, let me go back to this idea of what is required of an FBI director. And this came up a number of times during the testimony when people were asking if the removal of James Comey would then have an impact on the investigation. How do we know what effect removing that director could have or might have?
If anybody's intention was to remove a director for the purpose of impacting an investigation, they wasted their time. I will tell you, the FBI carries on. The agents working cases are going to do what they're supposed to do, and they may receive direction by people to say, for example, close the case. If that was a direction that was inappropriate because there is a viable crime that has been committed and needs to be presented, that would be protested. It would not go over easily. I will tell you, in my 21 years with the FBI, I never saw an instance of where politics got in the way of pursuing cases. Now, the FBI, of course, doesn't indict. We investigate. We find the facts. I like to think of ourselves as scientists. We come back with the information. We present it to a grand jury. We present it to the United States Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice. What they decide to do with it is out of our control. But nevertheless, it is not going to slow down any investigation that may be going on involving the Russians or anything else because James Comey was asked to leave.
So then, Rhonda, what kind of high-profile investigations has Christopher Wray been connected to that might give us a clue to his law enforcement credentials?
Well, he was involved in the Enron investigation. He also played key roles in the anti-terrorism cases that came right after 9/11. So those are at least two situations he's been involved in.
And John, you say that you're okay with the choice of Christopher Wray, but it's possible someone else might have been better. Are you saying you would have preferred a judge?
Not necessarily a judge, but I've looked at some of the candidates who are out there. Jana Monroe, for example, former assistant director of the FBI. She started the FBI's cyber division, one of the leading females in the FBI. 30 years in law enforcement, 10 including on the local level as a homicide detective, 20 in the FBI to the highest ranks. John Pistol, who spent 25 years with the FBI, then went on to TSA. Mike Mason, our first African-American executive director at the FBI. There were a number of people that have extensive law enforcement and private sector experience, just like Mr. Wray, that were briefly considered. But these are all very strong individuals when it comes to making decisions to lead investigations. Probably not the most politically correct persons. Perhaps that's why they were not seriously considered.
That is retired FBI Special Agent John Iannarelli and AJC reporter Rhonda Cook. John and Rhonda, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show, but we would love to hear from you. Do you have an opinion on who should be the next director of the FBI? Or let me put it another way, do you think the FBI has been compromised by what's gone on between the Trump administration and James Comey? You can reach us on Facebook or on Twitter, or just call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.